I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We've reached the middle of October, and although there have been a handful of coronavirus cases associated with Vermont schools, there have been no widespread outbreaks of COVID-19 in any of our schools, a big relief to many. But cases are on the rise around the state and have been significantly rising around our region and country, and we're heading into late fall and winter, when meeting, socializing, and having classes outside becomes more difficult in many cases. So today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk about how Vermont can continue to try to keep our case count low. And we're going to answer any questions you have for the health department on COVID-19 issues. But we're also going to focus on ventilation and making the indoor air you're working, studying, and living in as safe as possible. We're joined now, as we are many weeks, by Tracy Dolan, Deputy Commissioner for the Vermont Department of Health. Deputy Commissioner, welcome back.
Hi, good afternoon.
And to help us go through those ventilation and HVAC issues today is Bill Irwin. He's Chief of Radiological Health Programs at the Health Department, and during the pandemic, he's the Health and Medical Branch Co-Director for Statewide Emergency Operations, which means he's focusing a lot on PPE and indoor air quality. Bill Irwin, thank you for joining us. It's nice to have you.
You're welcome, Jane. Thank you.
So, Tracy Dolan, let me just start with you because some of the news that's coming out today relates to schools. And as I mentioned, there are no widespread outbreaks in Vermont schools. And Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine has been at pains to note that so far there is no known transmission that has occurred at any Vermont schools. Nonetheless, we are now looking at 5 schools in Vermont as of today that have cases within their community. So whether that's somebody who works at the school or somebody who goes to the school as a student, in some cases it's not public, which sort of category the person is in. But 5 schools have sent notes out to their community saying somebody has tested positive within our school community. I think that might make many people feel a little bit nervous. What can you say about what's known and how nervous we should or should not be?
Sure. First, I can share that, and I believe Dr. Levine spoke about this earlier today. We have South Burlington High School, Williston Central, Windsor, Manchester Elementary, and then most recent Essex Elementary Schools, I think, informing their communities. And the question, should people be nervous? Certainly, we expected that we would have some cases once school came back in. I think what's really important to note is that schools appear to be doing a really good job with all the mitigation measures that they've put in place. The masking, the distancing, they're wiping down surfaces. And because of that, we really are seeing no transmission within the school between students, for example, and students and staff. And that is a really great success. So nothing unexpected in these cases, but I can understand why parents might be concerned. Any uptick in cases is going to concern folks.
Yeah, and I think the uptick in cases generally is concerning folks because, you know, at what point might we have to go back into into more restrictive measures, which may or may not include more remote learning for schools, but also other things that people experienced in the spring and are at pains to try not to experience again. But, you know, it sometimes feels like individually you have little control over what happens, although collectively we have some control over it.
We do. And, you know, I think the key that we're seeing now is in the region, we've got increases happening around us. We have more counties showing up in the yellow or red zone, which really impacts travel. And so one of the messages we're really putting out there is to be very cautious about your travel. Quarantine is not optional. If you go to a yellow or red zone county, you are required to quarantine for 14 days when you come back, or up to 7 or 8 or 9 days if you want to try to test out on day 7. When Dr. Birx visited this weekend from the White House, that was one of her main precautionary tales for us, highlighting a few other states that had low positivity rates like us, but watching those climb primarily because of travel-related infection rates. And so that's one piece that's really important for people to remember, particularly families with kids in schools as well. As we're entering the holidays here, continuing to do everything you can to keep Vermont safe, to keep the kids and the staff safe as well.
Why did Dr. Birx come to Vermont in person? I mean, when we had Dr. Fauci join one of the press conferences, he joined by video chat or not in person. Why did Dr. Birx come to the state?
She came to the state. I can't speak to why she chose to come in person, but she came to the state in part because we have had a very successful college reopening, and she wanted to visit some states to find out some of the success stories. And one of the success stories here that she was exploring was the college reopening. And so she visited UVM to learn a little more about testing protocols, all of the prevention that was put in place prior to students arriving, and to learn a little bit about our plans as we move into the winter and spring with the schools.
Was the state involved in facilitating her visit? I mean, given especially that she probably didn't quarantine, even if coming from a different kind of county. And, you know, so how did that happen?
Oh, Jane, you asked really great questions. I do not think we were involved in the facilitation of the visit. I think this was a choice of the White House, but certainly, Dr. Levine, appropriately masked and distanced, did meet with her and spoke with her, as well as the Secretary of the Agency of Human Services. But I am not privy to the details of how her visit was facilitated.
Just briefly, before we go into some of those air quality issues and other things, and I do want to talk more, Tracy, as well about traveling and how we should think about that as the holiday seasons approach. But first, let's talk a little bit about this. Do we call it an outbreak or a cluster of cases associated with both youth and adult hockey in the Montpelier area? It's, 12 cases known so far?
Yeah, and I can certainly describe how we define an outbreak. So an outbreak depends on the setting, but it's usually 2 or 3 or more cases, depending on the setting, that are epidemiologically linked or that have some kind of linkage. And so the hockey situation would be an example of something that we would see as an outbreak because there's linkages there. And so we're still investigating that, learning a little bit more about it. One of the interesting points it brings up is around sports. It is possible that playing the sport itself is not particularly risky, but it may be that other activities before and after the sport could be. So it could be the carpooling or other ways that teams get together. So that'll be a good learning for us to learn a little bit more about how either the youth or the adults were cohorting or, gathering with each other there. So we're learning as we go. We have the best contact tracing team in the country as per CDC. And so they are quickly tracking down any contacts, reaching out to cases, and encouraging testing among those teams.
But not
for those who haven't been tested.
So encouraging testing for team members, not encouraging, as Dr. Levine said today in the press conference, not encouraging community testing for asymptomatic people in the Montpelier Barrie area. Sometimes that does happen. We saw, for example, Porter Hospital in Middlebury was open for asymptomatic testing last week, even though the outbreak at Champlain Orchards was considered to be contained within the orchard itself. So why not encouraging asymptomatic testing of community members who live in and around the Barrie-Montpelier area?
Well, right now, during the investigation, so far, the contact tracing is finding that so far, with the information we have, it appears to be contained to this team and their close contacts. If we were to learn more and learn that there was a broader community transmission, we would encourage that. We're certainly not telling people that they can't get tested, and so they could look to their community and see what testing sites are available. But right now, the state is focused on the contact tracing, and we'd make a different decision if we learn different information.
So, Bill Irwin, let me bring you into the conversation here. And again, listeners, Bill Irwin is chief of radiological health programs at the health department. And, you know, part of his job during the pandemic, since everybody seems to be doing, you know, multiple jobs and working to make sure that they're doing extra things to keep Vermont safe, is he's medical branch co-director for statewide emergency operations. And Bill, you focus a lot on PPE, personal protective equipment, and indoor air quality. Are those things that you already knew a lot about? So does this feel easier? Has this been a steep learning curve?
Well, Jane, in addition to working with the health department, radiological health issues, where we have to be concerned about the indoor air quality for radioactive materials, for facilities that use radiation, I'm one of the chief officers of the state hazmat team and have a lot of experience there working with chemical and biological agents. But it's really the emergency response capabilities that are incorporated into everything we do at the health department to make sure that we're ready for these kinds of experiences. And that has really led to me being able to help out there at the State Emergency Operations Center for the health department.
So when we told listeners, Bill, that we were going to be talking about indoor air quality and ventilation and looking at it sort of from a broad perspective, but as well at what people can actually do themselves, whether it's in a business setting or a childcare setting or in a home, we got a lot of questions and a lot of responses. So why don't I just jump in with some of the listener questions that we got to, and then if there's anything that we're missing, you can let us know, you know, what piece of the puzzle is missing that we should still talk about. So I want to start with Jennifer in Middlebury, who says, we operate a child care center in our home. How can we ventilate better while still keeping our costs down?
Yeah, that's a great question that nearly everyone has right now, because obviously with days like today and others already, winter is coming, and we always know it's going to be difficult to manage the heating costs. So it's really most important to recognize that of the means that coronavirus is transmitted, the airborne pathway is the least likely. Contact, transmission, touching surfaces, getting close to people, and droplet transmission, where someone coughs, someone sneezes, those are the primary means. So everything that we've been doing, and really been doing very successfully for almost 8 months now, physical distancing, covering the mouth and nose, hand washing, disinfection, staying home when sick, those are going to be the most important things we continue to focus on. In fact, we need to redouble those when we spend more time indoors. Now, there are some things that we can do that help with indoor air quality. We can go into a few of those too. But again, it's really focusing on those primary routes of transmission.
So, okay, so just to reiterate, because that's important, Bill, is that what you're saying is the other steps that we're taking, not ventilation and not air quality concerns, but things like wearing masks, making sure that we stay away from people when we're sick, wiping down surfaces, washing our hands, all of those are going to be more effective than concentrating on air quality, because airborne transmission is so far still seen to be a smaller path of transmission or a less common path of transmission than the large droplets and coming in contact with surfaces and people ourselves. Yes?
Yes. But if people can invest in activities that improve the indoor air, that's not only going to pay dividends for coronavirus and preventing the transmission of COVID-19, but also for a wide variety of things that indoor air quality is associated with. And of course, there are
like what?
A number of things. Well, first, let's just start with physical distancing, avoiding crowded spaces. So when you can, if you see that there is just too many people in a space, it's time to move on. Maybe it's also good to spend less time in those kinds of places. But when we think about indoor air quality, we often think about some of the more expensive things. It's not always expensive that is necessary. For example, if you simply keep your heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system, we call that HVAC, operating as effectively as possible, checking the filters, making sure that they need to be changed, that they are changed. If you can, upgrade those filters to a higher MERV rating. MERV stands for Minimum Efficiency Reporting Value. One of the things that I caution people with is when you make changes like upgrading your filters, you want to make sure you either follow the instructions of your HVAC system or you get a professional to make sure that you're not burdening the HVAC system with a too high a rating on that filter. And then there's some other things, for example, air purifiers. If you use them in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions, those can help remove particles, including viruses. And that's not just coronavirus, it's influenza virus and any other droplet or airborne or contact transmitted infectious diseases. And one of the other things that is specific to winter, as we all are feeling that approaching fairly rapidly, is humidity. We found in science that the coronavirus thrives in drier humidity conditions. So if you can keep your relative humidity between 40 and 60%, that helps. I have three wood stoves that I use to heat my home, and I put a pot of water on all of them so that it boils and puts water into the air to keep the relative humidity up. And then you might also, if you've got the wherewithal to do it, invest in some room humidifiers. But again, make sure anything that you do, you do so in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions.
Bill, I'm glad you mentioned the low-tech version there as well. You know, you were talking about filters and MERVs, and it's like, well, what if you heat with wood? And, you know, what if you got no filters to improve with? But, yeah, that idea that you can increase the humidity in your home, and that may actually help.
Yeah, we recognize that not everyone can, especially when there's been little time to plan for it, invest in significant improvements in their HVAC system. But if you do what you probably would like to do anyway, have it checked out, make sure it's operating at top efficiency, make sure the filters are clean, changed regularly as they need to be, you're probably going to not only, again, see dividends with coronavirus prevention, but also with other kinds of indoor air quality issues that we'd like to prevent in healthcare too.
Yeah, can you just tick off what those might be, the other issues that you could also be improving in addition to, you know, to coronavirus prevention or COVID prevention?
Well, obviously there is influenza, which is going to be competing for all of our resources, healthcare and for hospitalizations and just our time away from school or away from work if we get ill. And so that's an important one to try to improve. And most of those things that I described will help with that as well. But nearly every kind of infectious disease can be transmitted through droplets. And in that way, cleaning and trying to make sure that we are doing good hand washing and covering the mouth and nose, even before and after COVID-19, you know, good cough etiquette to perhaps sneeze or cough into your elbow or into a handkerchief. All of those things help, but it's really most anything that is potentially infectious through that route. And we do have a number of chemicals in our homes. Those too can be removed from the air with these kinds of filters built into HVAC systems.
So, Bill, we got a question from Francis who says, I'm a school librarian, period. Safety and fire code regulations require our doors stay closed at all times. The library does not have any windows and is located in the center corridor of the building. Administrators have assured us that the ventilation systems are up to date and working properly. But are there any other simple steps I can take to further improve air quality?
Well, that's a really good question, and that's one of the more difficult scenarios where you have difficulty with opening windows or opening doors. And in that case, it could be that a room filtration system, a portable system, oftentimes equipped with what's called a high-efficiency particulate air filter, that might be useful for cleaning the air in that library. And that would probably do the trick, along with all the other coronavirus protection mechanisms that we've, again, been using so well, trying to make sure you redouble those in the wintertime when we are closing up our windows and doors and staying inside more.
Bill, we have more questions about ventilation and HVAC systems and what to do in people's personal situations. And I know you're not consulting with them on their exact home specifications or business specifications, but I think a lot of these are helpful to other people as well. So let's go to one that Paula, who's the library director at the Greensboro Free Library, asks. So Paula says, I'm hoping to keep my library open through the winter for our brief patron visits. I want to maintain staff and patron health. It's possible our building's old windows allow for enough air changes to clean the rooms, but I'm wondering about possible air filters. I've seen a design for a low-cost solution, MERV filters taped to form a box, on top of which is placed a box fan blowing air up, thereby pulling it through the filters. Would this work? So maybe you could speak, Bill, to Paula's specific question, but also to a lot of people who might be looking for sort of DIY solutions.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's nice also to hear two librarians. My wife is librarian for the town of Bakersfield. But the idea of trying to keep those places open is great because a lot of people do use the internet and obviously get books, and it's a place where a lot of important information is exchanged. And I do believe that it is possible with older homes such as I have, for example, it will get more air changes than you likely would with a very tightly fitted window, door, highly insulated modern construction. But I think that the key things, again, besides what I've reflected on related to trying to do all that we've been doing for droplet and contact transmission, is to try to think about what was mentioned there, that they are brief visits. If you can reduce the number of people in the space, that reduces the risk of airborne transmission. If you reduce the amount of time that people spend in these spaces, it reduces the possibility of airborne transmission. And then it's really nice in a library that you keep your voice low. What they call expiratory exertion, singing loud, shouting, very loud voices, and coughing, sneezing, each of these puts more virus particles into the air if they exist in the person. And in that way, it's possible that a library with it quiet is actually going to be a little bit safer place. And then using that simple technology that I described from a manufacturer is much more preferred than making a design of your own. I actually got a email request through the Commissioner of Health about a school teacher who wanted to do this. Great, smart idea. But the problem is that when it was done, and I think it was actually in Wired magazine, that they had tested it using laboratory conditions. They were able to really control the circumstances and measure the effectiveness. Unfortunately, we're a little worried that someone might build something that could potentially make things worse when maybe for just a little bit more financial investment, you can obtain an actual air purifier with a HEPA filter built into it that is going to do, as it's designed by the manufacturer, clean up that air effectively.
So that's the concern, Bill. It's not that, you know, it may do nothing. It's that there is a possibility that you could actually make things worse.
There is a possibility. Anytime, in fact, you operate a fan in a room, it is likely to potentially redirect the particles that might be in the room. It could, in fact, lead to some drying of droplets that are on surfaces. And that drying of droplets on surfaces before they can be cleaned is something that we want to try to avoid. And when the fan stirs it up and spreads it around, it may actually cause more harm than good. So, again, try to do things in accordance with the guidance that you get from either a professional who's really looking at the specific circumstances of the place, and then also in accordance with what the manufacturer has taken time to incorporate into their designs as a professional commercial product.
So, Bill, you mentioned, you highlighted the fact that we're hearing from librarians, and we have another one. And in my head, I'm wondering, you know, are all the library questions coming in because many of our libraries in Vermont are in older buildings? You know, many of our libraries perhaps haven't had facilities upgrades in a long time. Speaking of my town now, too, and thinking about, you know, the library, which just operates on a shoestring budget. But Barbara Ball at the Windsor Public Library says, our library's children's room is in the basement. It has unopenable basement windows. The bathroom is also in the basement and does have an exhaust fan in the window. What can we do to get the air exchanged?
Yeah, that's another tough one. And again, maybe looking at the total amount of exposure, so limiting the amount of time there, limiting the number of people there is important. Sometimes, as we all have, we need to sort of redesign our lives. And it might be better to think about moving that up into a better ventilated space. Maybe think about the way you schedule things. For example, if you actually allow the space to clean up for some time, what we call air changes per hour are occurring with any kind of ventilation system. And if you give it an hour or two, even for less than ideal HVAC system, it may actually clean up any of the leftover contaminants, whatever they might be in the space, and make it easier for you to go in there and reuse that later. Rather than look at continuously operating, you might have breaks where you operate for an hour, take 30 to 60 minutes, operate for another hour, maybe move some of your operations around. You could still deliver those really important services, but maybe you just do it a little different fashion than you used to. And hopefully for just handful of months more, we hope, before we can actually start to turn the corner on this thing.
Hmm. Let's go to Oliver, who's calling in from Middlesex. Hi, Oliver.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
So I had a question about the humidity comment. Bill was saying that the virus doesn't like humid environments and prefers drier environments. But, you know, as far as my understanding is, you know, what my doctor told me is that, you know, most viruses and bacteria, they're swimmers, so they need moisture to transmit. And, you know, with all the water droplet stuff in the air, I mean, that's what we're all worrying about, is water droplets carrying the virus. How is the virus... I'm just trying to understand why drier environments are better if it needs water to transmit.
Yeah, Oliver, interesting question. Tracy Dolan, can I start with you, and then Bill, we can come back to you. What about
actually,
that?
Actually, I think Bill was speaking actually the opposite. I think he was saying increasing the humidity would be more beneficial in this case. So I'm going to bounce it back to
yeah,
Bill.
So Bill, beneficial because it would prevent virus transmission. So Oliver's question is, if the virus, you know, is sort of prefers a drier area in terms of transmission, so you want to increase the humidity to prevent transmission, but the virus itself is being carried on droplets. Just can you explain that?
Yeah, let me just try to be real clear. The science on this is fairly new, but it's especially stronger with SARS-CoV-1, the original SARS that severe acute respiratory syndrome that occurred in Hong Kong, in China, and elsewhere in 2003. And what has been learned recently with SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, is similar. And that is that if you have the humidity, relative humidity, between 40 and 60%, that's best for indoor air. If it goes below that, it gets too dry and it begins to cause a more rapid evaporation of the moisture and actually releases the virus particles that have been trapped in a droplet on a smooth surface. When you go above 60% humidity, you start to get more moisture in the air. That's when it too can be problematic. So that's why we shoot for that kind of sweet spot of relative humidity between 40 and 60%. And again, we're talking about indoor air. So it often is a little bit different depending on the context of some of the guidance that you might read. If, for example, it's talking about tropical climates versus arid climates, but we're talking about indoor air.
Hmm. All right. That's interesting. Let's hear from Fred, who's with us from Peru, New York. Hi, Fred.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, go right ahead.
My question is not only for libraries, but maybe for homes, especially people living, older people. Would a plant, or are the particular plants that might be helpful to have in the facility?
Yeah, what do you think about that, Bill? Could plants help?
Absolutely. Plants are just wonderful things for us to incorporate into our lives. In general, as everyone should know, they remove carbon dioxide from the air and they create oxygen in the photosynthesis process. That's always beneficial. And in fact, we often look at carbon dioxide as kind of a measure of good air quality. If you can keep the carbon dioxide levels down in your home, it's generally better for us. So I heartily recommend that if you can keep your plants thriving in the winter, that you use them, they will improve the air in your home.
All right, Tracy, here's one for you. Patty emailed in to say, would it be helpful for me to wear a mask inside my home if other household members are essential workers and are at risk to contract COVID-19 at work?
So this is someone who's living at home with either family members or roommates who regularly work in another setting.
Yeah, it sounds like that. Yes, and I don't know whether Patty's concern is, you know, for herself contracting the virus from the people she lives with, or if she's trying to protect the people that she lives with who are essential workers from contracting it from her. But, you know, regardless, I guess the question is, should she be wearing a mask even inside her own home?
Generally, we haven't recommended mask wearing unless somebody is ill or needs to quarantine, in which case they may be moving through rooms or common living spaces, or if they're isolating and need to move through a common space. But generally, we haven't encouraged mask wearing. It doesn't mean you can't. There's certainly no harm in wearing a mask. And if she would like to do that and felt more comfortable doing that, but if somebody is not feeling well, they should see their doctor, of course, get a test if they have COVID symptoms. But assuming there is no obvious illness or symptoms, we wouldn't generally recommend wearing a mask unless you chose to, but it wouldn't be a health department recommendation.
So let's go to Emily, who's calling in from Burlington. Emily, you're on the air.
Hi there. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Great. I am a teacher, and myself and many of my colleagues teach in classrooms that regularly exceeded 1,200 parts per million of carbon dioxide during the winter months of this past school year, according to the CO2 meters in our classrooms. And I'm aware that the updated CO2 limit for COVID safety, given the now acknowledged risk of airborne transmission, is 800 parts per million, down from the prior 1,200 limit that was advised. And according to that guidance, our classrooms will be dramatically less safe once these winter months start. I noticed that you were mentioning the fact that air exchange can occur to make the classroom a lot safer and probably bring, or any room safer, and bring down carbon dioxide levels. But during the colder months, it won't be feasible for us to bring our students outside for that extended period of time because of temperature and, of course, that they would miss out on learning in the classroom. The ventilator units in our classrooms are also not compatible with MERV 13 rated filters. They're compatible with up to MERV 8. And we do not have ceiling ducted ventilation. So my big question is, does the Vermont Department of Health have any plans to update school guidance or make guidance more stringent, for example, required rather than recommended, or a plan to hold schools more highly accountable for indoor air quality and maintaining safe CO2 levels as an indicator for exhaled air levels in general in the classroom? And are our classrooms really able to be considered safe once we enter these colder months?
Okay, very specific there, Bill. But, you know, Emily's obviously got all of their numbers correct and you know, wants to know specifics about how to stay safe. What would you say?
Well, I would say, first of all, that anything relative to enforcement of guidance and compliance, those are issues for the school, for leadership, and certainly glad to have Deputy Commissioner Dolan weigh in on that as well, if she'd like. I think it's great to have a teacher that understands what is in our guidance relative to carbon dioxide, for example, in this particular case. And hopefully, because of this great effort that the state has undertaken to try to bring some investment in ventilation improvements in the schools in particular, can be looked at for Emily's particular school in Burlington to see if maybe there's a way to improve those spaces relative to the introduction of some additional outside air that will help with the reduced carbon dioxide, or help reduce carbon dioxide levels. But again, if that's difficult, or all the things that can be done are being done. It could be that you look at the occupancy numbers, you look at the occupancy times, and maybe there's a way to make some changes there too, to bring those carbon dioxide levels down. Because indeed, at 1200 ppm, we would prefer to have some sort of mitigation to improve it down to those lower values of 800 or less.
Deputy Commissioner Dolan, do you have anything to add?
Sure. I would just say, if anyone was concerned about the air quality in their facility, in particular school, the first stop would be the school administration. And then, continued discussions with your administration or with the Agency of Education, that would probably be your first stop. But I think opening up these discussions is important. And again, just a reminder, pulling up to the 5,000-foot view, this is one mode of transmission. However, it's probably the least likely mode of transmission of the modes of transmission that we're aware of. Again, the respiratory droplets, that close contact within 6 feet for 15 minutes or more is the key one that we're seeing, certainly in Vermont and across the country. And then, also surfaces are important. This is one, but it is not the one that gives us the greatest concern, but it's certainly another thing to think about and to try to improve.
Deputy Commissioner Dolan, Kate emailed in to say, while the state determines best practices for indoor winter sports sponsored by schools, private club sports are moving full steam ahead. My daughter plays soccer for a local club, and their indoor season starts in early November. Practices and games are held at the Champlain Valley Expo, and kids will be required to wear masks. I've been told there will be a maximum of 150 people in the building. Would indoor soccer be a reasonably safe or demonstrably unsafe? What metrics should I use to help me make this decision?
Oh, that's a great question. So we are currently updating and discussing some of the guidance around athletics, both for colleges and for K-12.
And so for those clubs? Because, this one is not even school connected necessarily.
Yeah, no, it's primarily for school. And so I would guess that the same principles, because we're really applying the same principles to young people in this case, would be relevant for clubs. I don't know if the guidance will call out clubs, but certainly clubs could use the guidance. Soccer is one sport that we have been allowing so far. I think the use of masks is important. And I would really caution people to think about the sport, but also activities before and after. We are learning a little bit about carpooling and other kinds of gatherings that might be actually higher risk than the sport itself. So I would hold tight and see if the K-12 guidance might offer some support there to any decision making. But some of the things to consider really are the pieces around the close contact for long periods, and the number of people in a building. It sounds like they are utilizing the regulations that are set out by ACCD in terms of how many people can be in the building. And again, that guidance should be out fairly soon.
Does the state have any influence on what happens at the college level? It sounds like, yes, in some cases. We know that, for example, NESCAC, which Middlebury College and other regional schools are a part of, have canceled intercollegiate competition for winter sports. So, what role does the health department play in figuring out the college guidelines?
So we advise the colleges, we meet with the health leads, and we are also part of the Restart Committee. And the Restart Committee provides guidance that the college presidents weigh in on. And for the most part, it's been a really good relationship. It's been very collaborative, and we've had really full agreement on both sides. I know that colleges that are involved in the NCAA, where they are partaking in that, they're following NCAA guidance, and some may choose to go beyond that. For those colleges that are not part of NCAA, they may use other kind of criteria and regulations to determine how they're going to move forward with their sports. But those decisions are being made in the coming days.
Tracy Dolan, another thing that we could talk about today are those guidelines around when to consider going back to a workplace or a school setting or a childcare setting. And in some cases, those are delineated pretty clearly by either the school or the childcare through the health department guidelines or through, an office. But we're also seeing some conflicting guidance and guidelines when we look at what's happening, for example, with some of our federal government officials about, when they're determining it's safe to return to in-person work. So, how should Vermonters be thinking about this?
So we have a nice clear answer on this. In Vermont, if you test positive for COVID-19, you should isolate at home until these three conditions have been met. At least 10 days have passed since the onset of your symptoms. At least 24 hours have passed since the resolution of a fever and when other symptoms have improved. So you wait 10 days since you first got symptoms, 24 hours since your fever resolved without any ibuprofen and other symptoms improving.
And that's it. That's sort of all you need to know. But then couldn't your office or your child care facility have some different guidelines over and above that as well?
They may have something over and above, but this is our standard that we're using here at the Department of Health. So some may have something even more conservative where they ask for more days, and they're certainly allowed to do that. But these are the guidelines that we've put out.
Another question on what to do about air quality for you, Bill Irwin. John in Middlebury says, do you know of any effective ultraviolet light device that can be left on when people are in the room?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad it was asked, because ultraviolet generating devices can actually disinfect and do so quite effectively. Oftentimes they are installed in the ductwork so that there's no exposure to people. It merely exposes the air as it passes through a plenum part of the HVAC system. But you can install ultraviolet generating infection controls in an open space as well. The guidance is that you have it above in the room, above head height, and pointed towards the upper elements of the space there. And that way it doesn't illuminate the individual skin or eyes. The ultraviolet radiation generated by these devices can harm the skin and can harm the eyes. But if it is placed properly, pointed upward, not only does it prevent that kind of exposure, but it actually does a good job of disinfecting in those upper spaces. And then as air circulates up and down with the natural convection, it will disinfect a lot of that space in there. It's a little bit expensive. And again, we caution, it's best to have this done by a professional so that it is done safely.
Tracy Dolan, let's talk about testing sites. A lot of the testing has been done outside for COVID-19 throughout Vermont through these nice warm months. What is happening with state testing sites or with state guidelines for testing through the winter?
Sure. So we are looking at that now. Already some of it has moved inside because we had some, well, earlier in the season, we actually had some days that were too hot. So we had to test inside there. And so that's when we really began to look at what kind of workflow we needed to make sure that happened safely. The use of appointments is really important so that we don't have crowds in rooms. Making sure that we have enough space in a waiting area so that if we do have more than one person, there's plenty of space. Making sure we have the right PPE because it's inside. I was just on with the colleges this morning, and one college has rented a mobile van that they will be using outside when they're testing symptomatic students. And so people are getting creative, and we'll continue to do that. Hospitals are stepping up with testing, which has been great. You know, we heard from Porter Hospital today. You know, they've been helping out, and other hospitals as well, when there are clusters in their communities. And so they are either doing it inside or outside or coming up to people in their vehicles. So they may be able to continue to do that. The nasal swabs that are observed by either from a primary care office or a hospital is another way to allow someone to sit in their car and also be tested there. So there are a variety of ways. The pharmacies also utilizing testing inside. So I don't think we'll be challenged in figuring it out. It just takes a little bit of planning.
Bill Irwin, we've talked a lot about indoor air quality, but one of the other things that you're focused on in your job is PPE, personal protective equipment. And we heard from Public Safety Commissioner Sherling maybe last week, the weeks are starting to run together, whether it was over a Friday ago or last week, about the state's supply of various types of PPE. What can you tell us about what is sort of critical in terms of our need for more and where things stand overall with PPE in the state?
Yes, it's actually been one of our, I think, greater success stories here in the state. We realized in March, when the State Emergency Operations Center was activated, the Health Operations Center even weeks before that, that there was going to be a significant need for personal protective equipment, especially respiratory protection. And so we worked very aggressively in the state to try to find supplies when the whole world needed the same kinds of supplies. And we were able to find some N95 respirator alternatives. N95 is the best kind for most healthcare practices and most healthcare practitioners. But we also were able to obtain sterilizers, and we put them in 7 hospitals around the state. And the N95 respirators could be used to get taken to the sterilizers and reused after sterilization. So we've done a lot, and we hope that we're going to be prepared for a resurgence if that were to occur, because we've been very foresighted about this need being acute and getting things done with partners at UVM Health Network and with Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center and the State Building and General Services Agency.
Deputy Commissioner Dolan, does having a moderate to lower than normal flu season, will that be required in order for us to really feel like we're okay with hospital equipment and PPE?
You know, I anticipate so far, based on what we're learning in other parts of the world, that we will hopefully have a more moderate flu season, and all of that will help with PPE. We do have a fairly good supply of PPE now, and we've had a pretty good supply chain over the last few months, but encouraging everyone to get their flu shot, now is the time to do it. And just a final message, if I may, just really reminding people that travel is probably the theme of the week, and really thinking hard about the kind of travel that you feel like you need to do. Yellow and red zones are really a problem. And as we move into the holidays, this might be a time to hunker down and have some smaller family events and really think twice about either visitors coming in or going out of state, because that quarantine is really key to making sure that Vermonters stay safe through this flu season as well.
Well, we will definitely keep that in mind. Good point to end on. Tracy Dolan is Deputy Commissioner for the Vermont Department of Health. Bill Irwin is Chief of Radiological Health Programs at the Health Department and Health and Medical Branch Co-Director for Statewide Emergency Operations. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.